Spy Hunt is a Cold War espionage movie that grabbed you from the start. The opening scene is a train. If you love spy movies, you're now used to train scenes that started way back in 1935 with the 39 Steps and 1936 with Secret Agent. We now have been conditioned. Lots of spy movies have incorporated trains into their plot lines. So let's get to it. Hi, this is Dan.
And Tom.
Of SpyMovieNavigator.com and our show, Cracking the Code of Spy Movies. Your spy movie agents enhancing your viewing experience of spy movies for almost 5 years. All right, let's get into Spy Hunt. Spy Hunt's a great name for this movie, as we, the viewers, are constantly wondering who is on what side and who is a spy. It's based on a book called Panther's Moon by Victor Canning. And there's also a hunt going on with animals. Yeah. It's only about an hour and 14 minutes long. So this was indeed a B movie, meaning it was usually the second feature in a movie theater, made inexpensively, but usually by the big studios in the US and I think in Britain as well. For instance, here in Spy Hunt, the opening music is the exact same music they use for the Sherlock Holmes movies with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, like 1942. So
it's a good way to save some money, I guess.
Good music. Let's use it again.
Yep. All right. Hey, we'd like to give a shout out to a few of our group members who gave us feedback on some of our most recent podcast episodes. So a big thank you to Graham Thubrun, Ian Lowe, John Moss, and Jim Phelps.
Yeah, thanks, guys. We appreciate it. All right, for Spy Hunt, keep an open mind because many times B-movies are excellent.
Well, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't.
I said many times. All right, we're going to see elements in Spy Hunt that are reminiscent of The Lady Vanishes. We will see a note passed to another that we will definitely see in a 1959 Hitchcock movie, North by Northwest. And you will see dead drops. There's a MacGuffin, of course, and lots of suspense and intrigue, including a Black Panther hunt. Haven't seen that before, or since, actually.
Yeah, and Dan, we're gonna see and hear something that we see and hear in Dr. No.
Okay.
And it's a big one.
All right. Okay. That's a good teaser. All right. Released in 1950, it's directed by George Sherman, and the movie features Howard Duff, Martha Torran, Philip Friend, and Robert Douglas. The plot revolves around an American named Steve Quayne, played by Howard Duff, who becomes embroiled in a dangerous espionage plot as a non-spy, regular kind of guy. Now, that's a character type that we have seen many times in Hitchcock spy movies, of course. Spy Hunt explores themes of deception and international intrigue, which, of course, is typical of the spy thriller genre during the Cold War period. The film replicates and showcases the tension and suspicion prevalent during this era, with characters navigating a complex web of espionage and danger, much like what was happening in the real world, really. So that's pretty cool. It also offers a nice blend of espionage, mystery, chases, deceit, political intrigue, and romance. Yeah, okay. You Bond fans out there, come on. We get a little
romance. But remember, this is 1950s, so the romance isn't really explicit.
No, not too much. All right, so we have it all here. And of course, the backdrop is the Cold War, post-World War II tensions among the leading powers.
So immediately as the film begins, we see that some microfilm is being stuffed into a cigarette by a man aboard the train.
Yeah.
So we've got our train in this 1950s spy movie.
Yes.
We can go back to the general, the 39 Steps, 1935, to see one of the first spy movie train scenes.
Yeah.
So spy movies have to have trains in them. This one has it. So there's a shot for this movie, Spy Hunt, to be good.
Yeah, there you go. I like that.
Yeah, so instantly we get our MacGuffin, which is the microfilm, yep, and a train scene. So this has to be a spy movie because we have both of those.
Yeah.
Now, to me, at this point, I don't know if it's going to be a good spy movie, but there are two big spy movie tropes covered right up at the beginning.
Yeah, and again, you've got to keep in mind that these tropes we're talking about here are being developed at the time, at this time, in 1950. This is a 1950 movie. So we'll see some of them for the next 74 years in spy movies. So, and beyond that, probably, you know, right? So some of the stuff from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, they developed the tropes.
Yeah, so that's where they come from.
That's where they come from.
Including that one I'm going to talk about in Dr. No.
All right. We have a Western spy, Catherine Ulvan, played by Marta Turan, whose mission is to retrieve the microfilm. And then we have a small but significant number of suspicious characters, a newspaper man, a big game hunter, an artist, and we do not know their game, really. Are they what they say they are, or something else? So, the spy hunt is on. All right, let's look at what's good.
Wait, before you do that, I do have to say that if you don't know their game and who's what they say they are or aren't what they say they are, you're not paying attention.
Oh, no, I disagree. There's going to be a point of contention. Let's get into it. Let's look at the pluses and minuses, and we'll talk about that. All right, it's got a unique premise, for one. In a way, it's a unique premise. The film revolves around getting a MacGuffin, which, of course, we see in basically all spy movies here. It's the microfilm. All right, now this is the 1950s spy movie, so it's early to use this concept. But there was a movie 6 years earlier called Ministry of Fear, 1944, that starred Ray Milland, and, well, it focused on stolen microfilm. And there are many movies after it as well that have microfilm playing a big role in it, like My Favorite Spy in 1951 and The Thief in 1952, which also starred Ray Milland. All right, but here we see it in 1950, and it works in Spy Hunt.
Yeah, and I think actually it's more than just the microfilm that makes this premise unique, because we're talking about unique premises in this movie. And the way they hide the MacGuffin to transport it is very dangerous and unique. I don't remember seeing this technique in any movie before Spy Hunt, and I'd really have to scratch my head to think if I could find one since that used something similar to it as a way to transport the MacGuffin.
Yeah, there are multiple methods they use in this movie of transporting the microfilm that are unique.
Yeah, and one of them is very dangerous.
Yeah. Now, let's look at another plus here. There's a unique chase in this movie. The plot centers around getting this microfilm, and there may be numerous people trying to get it, perhaps representing various governments. But here in Spy Hunt, we see early on that Black Panthers will play an important role here. And yes, there is a unique chase, not cars, not boats, not planes, but a chase for the Black Panthers, which is kind of cool. By the way, as an aside, when they were shooting this movie, they actually used mountain lions dyed black for the Black Panthers.
Yeah, now that's an interesting point to me, because there are two different types of animals that can be called a Black Panther. And a mountain lion painted black isn't one of them.
Right? Yeah.
But because
for some reason they did that.
Yeah, now it's probably easier to get, especially in California. Because the family of animals that this comes from is called Panthera, and that's the tiger, the jaguar, the lion, the leopard, and the snow leopard. Both the leopard and the jaguar can be black. And when they are, they call it a Black Panther. The black leopards from Africa and Asia, the black jaguars from South America. But I think the ones in the movie were supposed to be black leopards, because with them using mountain lions, I guess with the dye, we now have a third species we could call a Black Panther.
I don't know. I couldn't find out why they really used the mountain lions, but they did. Maybe they were tamer. I would say maybe
if this was done in Hollywood, they might have had some trained mountain lions or whatever.
They may have had them available. Yeah, right.
And then so you just dye them black.
Or they may be under contract with the studio, mountain lions. All right, let's look at another plus, the scenic Swiss Alps. I mean, this takes place in Italy and in Switzerland and the Alps and so on, right? So there's a nice background. There are many, many nice shots that are breathtaking of the Swiss Alps during this panther chase and hunt, which adds intrigue, an international flavor, and a bit of travelogue, much like the James Bond movies would do later. Now, we think most of this movie was filmed in Hollywood, of course, with perhaps maybe the use of rear projection and even green screen to incorporate the Swiss shots. Now, we think most of this movie was filmed in Hollywood, with perhaps the use of rear projection or green screen to incorporate the Swiss shots. Rear projection has been used in films since the 1930s and green screen since the 1940s, so I think we see some of that here. But some shots are really nice.
Yeah, and you mentioned Italy before, and the shots aren't from Italy because the Milan stuff was a train station, so that was all shot in studio.
Yeah,
and you didn't see any backgrounds. Although I did find some of the dialogue pretty funny because you had people speaking Italian during the scene. So it comes up and says, Milano, you know, Milano train station, right? And then they have this like kid on the train whining, you know, and he's saying something, andiamo, andiamo, we got to go, right? And then you have this, a pair of adult lovebirds in a restaurant bar near the train, and they speak a little bit of Italian, but nobody else in the thing does. And it's like kind of like, hey, remember, this scene's done in Italy, which I thought that was kind of funny because they didn't use the background for it like they did for Switzerland.
It's a B movie. They don't have the money. They don't have the money.
It just sounded funny to me. But I did like when they incorporated the rear projection stuff because that was nice. That was a nice view of Switzerland.
Well, I mean, it's funny in a way, but I don't have a problem with people speaking Italian in the background for a scene that was supposed to be in Italy. So
My point is there needed to be more people speaking. You had the one little kid going, andiamo, andiamo, and then the two. That was it.
And why is it in Milan? Because the book, Panther's Moon, which is what this is based on by Victor Canning, well, the story begins in Milan. All right, let's get moving. All right, now we're going to look at this as an engaging mystery. It's not only a spy movie, but it's an engaging mystery. The search for the microfilm keeps viewers on the edge of their seats because we have a unique setting for the time. Plenty of suspicious characters, and we have the innocent player who's wrapped up in all of this. So, I mean, it could be us, right? That's what people look at. You're watching this movie, like you watch some of the Hitchcock movies where the innocent person is wrapped up in espionage. Hey, it could be you or me. That's kind of cool.
All right, so I'm going to disagree with you on the plenty of suspicious characters. They should be. But I thought very early on in this movie, you could tell who the bad guys were. I mean, they're trying to mask it, but I mean, you know, maybe not everybody can. I mean, I watch a bunch of spy movies.
I may
know how they film those things, pay more attention to that.
Yeah.
You know, now, so this could be one of those, your mileage may vary. But if you don't have it figured out right away, I suppose the mystery would work for you. I had it almost instantly. So
I don't know. Yes, we do disagree here because I thought they did a nice job mixing in a variety of elements in each of the characters to make a viewer wonder a little bit. So, you know, I'd agree with you, Don, but then we'd both be wrong. So there you go. All right, let's move on. Great sets. Besides the Swiss Alps, which is a pretty nice background, the main set was a hotel in the Alps, perhaps a ski resort, I think it was, and it was magnificent. This was a great set where you almost felt like you were in the inn with the main characters. That's how good it was. It looked cozy, real, and it looked believable. And the set directors were John P. Austin and Russell P. Gaussman. And this one set, and there were a few others, but this one was enough for me. It was so well done and looked so great and real. I loved it.
And I would totally agree with you that the hotel set was really done. I mean, I can see myself there.
Yeah.
Right?
And you felt like you were part of it.
Yeah. And so I thought that was really well done. Now, as for some of the sets.
And you know what else was good about it? You kind of knew your way around it after a while, right? You know, I'm going to go upstairs and go to the left. I'm in his room. That's how good it was. It was really good. Yeah.
It's really important to understand which room people are going into. So being able to pick up on that is a good thing. Now,
Pay attention.
The one thing I will say is I wasn't necessarily a fan of some of the sets when they were hunting the Panthers. At one point I had in my mind, boy, that kind of reminds me of Lost in Space.
There
were some of them I thought were good, but then there were some others that I thought were a little cheesy.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's look at another great positive here, another plus, the acting. All right, this is a B movie. You're thinking, okay, how good is this going to be? The acting was well above average and downright good. Martha Tauran as Catherine Ulvan, a Western spy posing as a journalist, is magnificent and adds so much depth to the story. She was in about 23 movies from 1942 to 1957. Unfortunately, she died young. I think she was only 37 when she died. But she was fantastic in this movie.
Yeah, and I'll agree with you. The way she works her face, it can.
Yes.
She's got, there's something there in the way yes. she can almost smirk while being serious.
Yeah,
and
a yeah.
couple point it requires it that I thought was really good.
Multiple levels she yeah. has. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
And the main actor in this then is Howard Duff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And right. he's the American Steve Quayne. And now he's the guy who gets to play the innocent man wrapped up in espionage.
Yes.
So if you know the 39 steps, this is your Richard Hannay.
Yeah.
I mean, and he was also really, really good in this.
Yes.
I also like the character who was an innkeeper and a doctor, yes. Dr. Stahl.
Yeah.
And he's not a main character in this thing, but Walter Slezak plays him, and it's a great character and extremely well played.
Yeah, he was fantastic. I would say he was near perfection on that because he, again, a very believable guy. He's got a couple of good lines about being both a doctor and an innkeeper. And towards the end of the movie, he says something to someone that's like,
"I can't decide whether you're better as a doctor or as an innkeeper.
I sometimes have my doubts which profession is the more difficult one. At least, when I lose a patient, he's no longer in a position to complain. With a guest, it's different."
That was good. All right. So that was fantastic. All the others in the cast, too, who are core to the story, are also terrific. Philip Friend as Chris Denson. He's been in like 16 movies, including Buccaneers Girl in 1950 and The Highwayman in 1952. Robert Douglas, who was awesome. He was Stephen Peridot. He's been in like 36 movies.
I really liked him in this.
He was fantastic. He was in The Fountainhead in 1949, The Desert Rats in 1953, Alan the Troy in 58, Tarzan in 1959. I mean, and he directed actually another spy movie, Night Train to Paris, in 1964. So, I mean, he was great. And then Philip Dorn, he played Paul Coppell, who has been in a few big movies like I Remember Mama, 1948, and The Kentuckian, 1949. They're all worth highlighting here because each played their part very, very well.
Fantastic. So, Dan, we are agreeing that the cast was good and they performed their roles well. So that's good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for a B movie, you're thinking, okay, you're almost telling yourself, well, you know, I'll accept some stuff that's not so good. Every one of these characters, including the police captain or whatever, they were all very, very good. All right, let's talk about some of the scenes. I think some of these scenes were very gripping scenes. There are a number of these scenes that kind of suck you right into the movie. And it opens with the man in the train, like we said. And what is he doing? He's stuffing microfilm into a cigarette. So we're not giving anything away here. You see that immediately. And then the dead drop, like you mentioned, there's a dead drop. And then the pursuit, all within the first few minutes of the movie. That was a great start.
I agree with you, Dan. I thought the opening was strong.
Yeah.
Now, I was surprised, and I had to rewatch this because I couldn't believe it. I was surprised that he was able to get that microfilm into the cigarette, given how little tobacco he removed. But they show him doing it, so I guess it did work.
My
question, though, is this. Unless someone handed him the microfilm on the train, why would he do this on the train? I mean, the train's moving a little bit. You know, train car's moving a little bit in the movie, but in reality, you get a lot more bounce out of a train car, especially back then.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised the tobacco didn't get all over the place.
Okay.
Now,
all right.
I also like the dead drop. I mean, it was done out in the open. I was surprised that the guys who were tailing the guy with the cigarette didn't catch on because it was pretty obvious as to what was going on. But I thought it was a well-executed dead drop.
I mean, that's a good point on where the man on the train got the microfilm in the first place. Maybe he actually got it from a dead drop, and now he's got to change the dead drop technique because as we talked to Andrew Bustamante, a real spy, ex-spy for the CIA, he told us that they do that kind of stuff. They don't want to use the same dead drop technique for the next time because it would be obvious. So, but there are indeed a few mysteries in this movie, for sure. Like, other than Istanbul being mentioned, we really don't know the country affiliations of most of these characters. I think we know that Catherine Ullman is at least a Western spy and most likely British, since she criticizes Quayne's American accent speaking English and she has a British accent. So I think that was pretty obvious to us. But the rest of it, you know, really don't know where they're from and what's going on. So, but I also want to point out these scenes with Catherine Ullman and Steve Quayne. It often reminded me of the scenes from the 39 Steps with Robert Donat and Madeline Carroll and their synergetic interactions or the closeness of the major players in Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes, for instance. So I thought that there was that kind of rapport between these characters that reminded me of these two other great movies.
Okay, and I'm shocked you didn't mention this. In the intro, I kind of teased this.
Oh, when, is this the Dr. No thing?
This is the Dr. No thing.
Okay.
All right. So when they meet, when Catherine and Steve meet, they're alongside a train car. He's in the train. She's outside of it. Yes. And she has a line where she says, "But maybe you will, mister," like trying to prod for his name. Quayne comes back with Quayne, Steve Quayne.
Ooh.
Looking for somebody?
Your little pet's there. I'm a correspondent from the Apex News Service, and I'd like an interview.
They won't talk.
But maybe you will, Mr.
Quayne. Steve Quayne.
Now, this movie came out 12 years before Dr. No. And we know one of the most famous lines in cinema history is Sylvia Trench saying,
"I admire your luck, Mr.
To which we get the famous retort.
Bond. James Bond.
Was this scene in Spy Hunt the thing that inspired the way they did the introduction in Dr. No?
That's fantastic. Actually, that's a great point, because that line that started the whole James Bond movie franchise is pretty much here in Spy Hunt, like you said. Yeah, I remember that now, because she's posing as a reporter and she wants a story on the Panthers, right?
Yeah.
And then she's telling him that he's in the train car with the Panthers, and he says they won't talk. And that's when she said, "Well, maybe you will, Mr." Yeah, that's fantastic. That's a great one. That's a great one. Hey, that's worth this movie right there. Right there. That's it.
What do we call that? Incidental intelligence?
Yeah.
Enhancing your fantastic viewing experience when you hear that. Now, if you watch this movie and you hear that when she says that line, boom, you're going to think Dr. No.
Yeah. And then there's other things in there, too. There's that, like we mentioned, a note drop where there's like a little warning written on a note for somebody, which is almost, well, the method is exactly like exactly what happens in 1959's North by Northwest. So that was also a cool part. This is 1950. This is pretty cool. And the cabin scene with the Panther and the final scenes are all, I think, solid. And there's some sabotage going on as well, and the train derailment, like you mentioned. And the ending, I thought, was pretty solid. There was some great final scenes, a couple of final scenes, actually, where you think, okay, that's it. No, that's not it. There's more. It's kind of like some of the Bond movies, like from Russia with Love. You think it's over, and that, boom, Rosa Klebs in there. At the end of the movie, like I said, it's really a good, solid final scene. And all I can say there is sometimes smoking helps. I'm not telling you anybody to smoke. That's our disclaimer. Do not smoke. It's bad for you. But in this movie, smoking helped a little bit.
Yeah.
And this cigarette could save your life, Mr. Bond.
Sometimes smoking helps.
Live twice, right? Yeah, all right. Okay, that's cool.
Sometimes smoking helps a lot. That's pretty funny, Dan. Now, there is a lot of smoking going on, and unlike what we saw when we saw Rozzy, there's no thing that pops up on the screen that says smoking kills. Right? Yeah. Almost everybody smokes, and a cigarette is used with explosive results toward the end of the movie. I mean, that was a really good use of a cigarette. Now, you mentioned the derailment, and I thought it was very well done.
Yes.
Now, although I don't know how they notified someone on the train to disconnect the cars outside of Brieg. I get the guy being outside of the train doing the derailment, Just not the person on the train who disconnected the cars. So either I missed something there, something came out in editing, or they figured nobody would ever comment on it.
Yeah, which is probably the most likely.
Yeah, we will. Okay. Also, there's a sign on the train tracks that says B-R-E-I-G. Yes. And the telegram also has that spelling. Now, if you tried to find that town on a map of Switzerland right now, you wouldn't find it because that's an old way they spelled it. It's now spelled B-R-I-G without the E.
Okay. All right.
Now, there is a town in Poland spelled the way they use it in the movie, but if the one in Switzerland, now they've dropped the E.
Yeah. All right. I think the point about how did the guy disconnect the car on the train so that they could derail it, how did they get a hold of that guy on the train? Because
we didn't have cell phones then, Dan.
It's an excellent point. I mean, the two bad guys who are the henchmen of this guy, Van A, who they call, he's at the Hotel Bristol in Zurich. They call him, right? His goons are calling him. And he orders the derailment of the train near Brieg, saying, I shall have it attended to. Now, how Van A, who we do not see for now, sounds familiar, doesn't it? gets word out to someone. How does he get word out to someone on the train to uncouple the car with the Black Panthers? That's a mystery. We don't see the train stop at any station before that. And it's moving briskly. So jumping onto it would be, impossible, really. But then again, Bond does that all the time. So I don't know. Maybe give him a break here.
Well, if you ever watched the movie Silver Streak, people leave the train all the time, especially the one character, Gene Wilder's character. Not many people hop on the train.
Yeah, hopping on a train, it would be rough. Yeah. But somehow, they did it. All right, let's look at some of the things that might be negatives or minuses here. Let's look at the production and the dimension of the movie. The film's rear projection or green screen effects probably means, like we said, it was mostly shot in Hollywood. There are nice shots of the Alps and the chase is nice and so on. But I think that's a fair critique. On location would have been far more intriguing, but far more costly. And B movies, well, the B doesn't stand for big budget. So I think there's your excuse. Yeah.
Now, and if you look up in IMDb filming locations, the only one they tell you is the studio lot.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Right, now, there is a line in this movie that wasn't meant to be funny, but I think for me showcases the B-movie look of this. During the hunt, one of the characters says, there's not enough snow to follow their tracks, talking about the Panthers. But everything in that scene was snow-covered with where they were. And later, you see paw prints in the snow. There was no new snow that came down that they showed you during the filming of this. Now, to be fair, some of the snow cover was spotty, but I think that that line showcases some of the production misses of the movie, because where they were standing, there was plenty of snow that you would have been able to at least start tracking from.
Yeah, but, I think, as you said, the snow was spotty in places, but the line is really meant to set up the fact that Paul Coppel's dogs could follow the trail. That, he was the big game hunter who never bagged the Black Panther before. And so I think that was the whole line, that his dogs can go follow the trail. We don't need to follow the footprints in the snow. So they had to get that in there because that's key. The dogs.
I just think with the amount of snow there, they could have used a different way to do that.
All right. Now, we'll look at the predictable elements. You're saying you knew the whole thing from the beginning. Well, okay. All right. Some plot development. Maybe.
Well, not from the beginning, from the hotel.
Okay, all right. So, I'll give you a little bit that some of the plot developments may be foreseeable, but the overall execution, I thought, and the acting and the storyline in general compensates for what we think. There are times when you might guess what is going to happen. But we think for the most part, I think for the most part, you're thrown into the movie and you are on edge as to what might happen next. There are some twists and turns that are just plain fun. And Hey, you might think that's going to happen or not, but so you think that way in lots of movies, and sometimes it does happen, and sometimes it doesn't happen, and you're a little surprised. So I thought that part was okay, but yeah. it is a critique in general.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, to me, the predictability is why I'm not a fan of this movie. It's a lighthearted movie. It's not that long. It's fine to watch. I just thought it was a little easy to pick up what was going on here.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is, there's that shot of a guy hunting the panther, and he is wearing a trench coat and hat. I mean, what message are they trying to send us with that? Who do they normally project in trench coats and hats in the comic series? In the comic series, Spy versus Spy, it's trench coats and hats.
He travels lightly. He's got one little suitcase. He's got what he's got. All right. Yeah. All right. Yeah. We do watch a lot of spy movies, but I think still they did a very good job on this here, because some of the final shots, and I mean shots from a rifle, not a camera shot, are intriguing. there's some revelations in those shots. And I think that was pretty cool. All right. Let's look at the pace and the character development. The pace is sometimes quick and action-oriented, and other times thoughtful and slower. But I'm going to say why that's okay. I thought the slower paced times were actually critical to developing the story and the characters in the story. And I think that time was necessary to set us up for what was really going on. So the times at the inn, for instance, sitting around and talking, playing chess, new guests are arriving. All this added to the intrigue and to the development of the story. So I thought that was actually pretty damn good.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm going to agree with you on something on this movie, because I agree with you on the pace. And I know you've read that that's a negative to this movie, and I don't understand it. The movie's only an hour and 14 minutes long.
Yeah.
Nothing was really slow to me, and I think those conversations at the inn are crucial for the character development.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I don't think this movie works for me without those type of conversations.
Yeah, I don't think so either. You need them. Those were mandatory. So Spy Hunt is a genuine find and an easy 1 hour and 14 minutes of fun for a spy movie fan. It will conjure up many other spy movies for you and give you exceptional entertainment for free. And it's on YouTube right now as of this review. It's fun.
Okay. Now, the fact that I could watch it for free, that I liked the acting, and it was only 74 minutes long, were big pluses for me.
Okay.
I disagree with you that this is a genuine find. However, it's harmless. It's fine to watch. I mean, if you have an hour and 15 minutes you want to kill one night just to watch something lighthearted, go ahead and do this. I do think there are much better spy movies to watch rather than Spy Hunt.
Well, okay. All right. That's what makes this kind of stuff fun, right? You can correctly agree with me and like this movie, or you can incorrectly agree with Tom and skip it. But I think you should see Spy Hunt. All right. That's a wrap. This has been Dan.
And Tom.
Having a lot of fun here with Spy Hunt at SpyMovieNavigator.com and our show, Cracking the Code of Spy Movies. Subscribe to our podcast show and give us a 5-star rating in your app. That way you can be in the know and we will reach more people. Hey, thanks for spending time with us. We appreciate it.